everybody, I'm Glenn Hill.
I'm Jacob Meyer.
Welcome to another Tactical Tennis Podcast, and today we're going to start talking about number 10 for Rafa at the French. Yeah, I mean, what a phenomenal achievement.
Just wow. I want to just jump all into this. I have like so many questions about where this ranks in the greater scheme of sports in general, but let's talk a little bit about the tournament and how it actually went.
Yeah, I mean, it was all Rafa. Like, there's a degree to it. It's almost, it doesn't matter what else happened in the tournament or who played well. Or, I mean, Rafa was just, I can't even say that he was on another level. It's
well,
like,
he was.
he was so far above everybody else that he made it seem like there were only two levels, you know, where it's just like there's where Rafa's playing and then there's just the rest of mankind.
Which I'm glad that you said that, because I was pretty interested and excited while the tournament was going on. And I was excited just at the notion that Rafa could get 10. But I mean, realistically, I didn't predict that he would just steamroll everybody like this. I mean, I think I've always said you cannot bet against that guy in Paris. Like, you
sure.
have to just be smart enough to know that he loves that court and there's nothing like that. But I mean, the guy was barely losing games. Like, how's that possible?
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, it's not like he had a sweetheart draw, which we've seen for players in the past, you know, they get just a great draw. I mean, he's beat some very, very good clay court players along the way. I mean, even just open with Pear in the first round. I mean, Pear's dangerous, and he gets Haas, Basilashvili, bloody hell, I always butcher that name, RBA. I mean, RBA's like really bloody good on clay.
He's like a top 20 player. He's
six,
one of the,
but not just
one
that,
of the
I mean,
10 best clay quarters like in the world.
Yeah, 6-1, 6-2, 6-2. I mean,
yeah.
Team, like, who's playing amazingly well, 3-4 and oh, like, he bagels Team on clay in the semifinals when Team's playing well. And then that final was absurd. I mean, it was absurd. The whole tournament, I mean, I think start to finish is probably the on the men's side, the most dominant Grand Slam performance that we've ever seen.
Yeah.
From anybody on any surface.
I remember,
in the Open era. I'll say in the Open era.
Years ago when he dominated Fed in a final. And Fed was almost embarrassed, but he was just like, look, I mean, you guys just don't understand, you know?
Right.
Like, he was playing, obviously, great tennis, and I think Federer, in his mind, thinks he's probably the second best clay court player of all time. And here he is, you know, getting dominated. And, of course, I'm going back a few years to when he really, really waxed Fed.
Yeah,
that
one final, yeah. Which, I mean, Fed played, had his own role in that. It's not like Fed didn't exactly go out there and bring his best. But, I mean, you also, one of the things that always irritates me when people talk about tennis and tennis fans is this idea of people tend to look at somebody playing badly and just say, well, they played poorly, and they forget that this is, I mean, a tennis match is an interactive thing. You influence each other in every way with every shot that you hit, and it's entirely possible to make somebody play badly.
Yeah, well, Rafa made everyone play bad.
You know, we can give credit to people when they make somebody play badly. Not many people actually make Fed play badly.
Fed said, I think he tried to imply those things, or at least said things that are similar to that, just didn't explain it as well. But, I mean, just to validate what you're saying, I thought Stan Wawrinka was playing really, really high-level Grand Slam tennis. Like, anywhere else, the way he was playing, it looked like he would have been on the way to another Grand Slam title.
Yeah.
And this is,
I mean, he brings his best. When he runs, the thing about Stan is, like, when he has runs like this at Grand Slams, he tends to win. I mean, he was 3-0 in Grand Slam finals leading into this match. You know, when we've seen him bring this kind of tennis at a slam, he's basically won it. And he did not have an easy draw either on his way there. You know, I mean, he played some tough players. He had to come up with some big-time results. You know, I mean, if we go back to right from the beginning, I mean, okay, so his first round maybe a little bit. I mean, he played, you know, Dolgopolov in the first round. I mean, second round, then he's got Fognini, who's incredibly dangerous. He drops a bagel and a two on Fognini. Monfils, who was playing really well, then takes out Cilic in straight sets. Murray in five, and then goes out of the final and just gets wrecked. I mean, I don't...
Let's be realistic here. in a single tournament, he beat Murray, Cilic, Monfi, Fognini, and Dolgopolov. Like, Dolgopolov is your easy second-round guy. Come on.
Right, and he only dropped two sets the whole way, and both of those were in the Murray match. Yeah, it was. He played great, and Nadal just destroyed him in the final. So let's talk about that final just a little bit, because, I got an interesting email from Martin, one of our listeners, who had asked me about that final and what my thoughts were on what Wawrinka could have done differently in order to impact the outcome. And that was actually a very interesting question. And I'm not 100% sure.
Was he could have done differently? Right. There's
this question of, well, you know, the things that he could have done, I'm not sure that are necessarily in his bag of tricks, you know, like in his repertoire. Because I really, when I think about it, like, yeah, I mean, I think he had to go out there and serve much better. I mean, I think maybe he needed to go out there and serve better than he is capable of serving.
Exactly.
Because he has never once come out, like, he doesn't go out and serve like Fed does on a good day, you know, where Fed can go out and just, like, light it up on the serve, hitting spots. I mean, Wawrinka doesn't really have days like that where he's just, you know, otherworldly with the serve. He's just, you know, like a good server. And then you've got, you know, so take the serve out of the equation. Then the only other big thing that I think he really can do to impact Nadal is to step up and take the ball earlier, kind of make it a little bit more of a court position battle. The thing that bothers me about that in this case is, one, Stan doesn't really like to do that. You know, he doesn't like to step up and take the ball on the rise and rob time away. I mean, he robs time away, but he does it just by hitting the ball really stinking hard from behind the baseline. And he's not really like a step up and take it early kind of guy.
His average forehand was like 84 miles an hour or something insane, which is really, really hard. Like, if you're inside the baseline, an 84, 85 mile an hour forehand basically goes to the other baseline. It might actually go over the other baseline.
Right.
So, I mean, you can't club the ball like that. And, I mean, keep in mind, that's an average, meaning he had to hit a ton of balls faster than that.
Sure.
I don't think you can really club the ball like that from inside the baseline unless someone's just giving you lollipops all day long. Certainly, Rafa wasn't going to let him do that.
Right. But, I mean, the other part of it, too, though, is also, I mean, if you're hitting the ball that hard and you're standing further back, I mean, spreading the court isn't really an option at that point. Right. I mean, there's this idea of, look, I can take the ball earlier. I don't have to hit it as hard because it's traveling a shorter distance, but that also opens the court where I can make somebody run more. I can take time away from them that way. But the issue to me on that is also, I don't think that that's your play against Rafa on clay. That, you know, the few times that we've seen Rafa really be vulnerable is when people just straight out overpower him, like hit him through the center, but incredible depth, incredible power, drive him back, get him to start dropping some forehand short, which he can do if you press him back far enough and take enough time away, and then punish that short ball. And you really have to punish that short ball. But, you know, I just don't know with the way that – the thing to me is the way that Rafa played is, I'm just not sure even that was an option. I mean, I just can't get out of my head that forehand that he hit when Stan drove that really deep, like high-quality backhand cross court, you know, just inside the baseline. And Rafa just, I mean, destroys his forehand down the line, 98 miles an hour. He cleared in front of him. Like, he finished in front of his shoulder. It wasn't like a buggy whip for him. Yeah. I mean, he just caught that ball out in front, and he was just so composed about it. But, I mean, he destroyed the ball. And Stan just didn't even have a whisper of a hope at it. And there's that moment where you just look at that and you're like, well, if the guy at the other end can do that off that type of ball, it's not that I'm amazed that Rafa hit a 98 mile an hour forehand. It's that he hit it off that shot where Stan like hit a huge backhand cross court with spin and depth and pace, and Rafa just said, okay, fine, whatever.
And he did it in a final.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, what do you do? So, I mean, there's a part where it's just hats off. I don't, you know, outside of serving better and maybe trying to step up a little bit, which I know isn't like Stan wants to do, but I don't really know what else he could have done differently. The only other thing I can think of is just more backhands down the line. You know, and really tried to turn into more of a backhand-backhand battle or a forehand-backhand battle. Stan can obviously hit enough pace and power that I think it makes it difficult for Rafa run around, but But how does that actually play out? I think you only know that one when you actually put him out there and they play it and you see. And in the past, his cross-court backhand's just been so good that he hasn't had to do that with people.
The only thing is, I think that pattern plays a little bit into Rafa. And I mean, the thing that stands out to me is Rafa is historically pretty conservative in finals. Like, he doesn't make a lot of errors. He tries to play with a lot of spin. He tries to move the ball around. He tries to play very, very hard. But historically, he's not a guy that goes and hits you off the court in finals.
Well, so, I mean, historically, that's not kind of what he tends to do in any matches for the most
part.
Yeah,
most of the time. But every now and then you get a weaker, you know, somebody who gives him a lot of time and he'll get very aggressive. But Stan didn't give him a lot of time. And when you're against him in a final and you're hitting the ball 90 miles an hour and he says, well, I'm just going to step up and hit this one a little earlier and hit it 98 miles an hour back at you. I mean, I don't know that anybody on the tour has an answer for that. The impression that I got was for Stan to win that final, he would have had to play a level of tennis that, to me, has never been demonstrated.
Hmm. That's a big statement.
Well, I mean, come on, let's be realistic. Like, he's not making
I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying it's a big statement.
I mean, he was playing a really high level of tennis. Like, can you imagine putting Borg or McEnroe out on that court with what Rafa was doing?
Well, I mean, yeah, I just don't like going that road because it was obviously a different era.
I know it's a different era, but I'm just making a point, right? Like,
I mean, yeah, you look at Borg, obviously a phenomenally talented clay court player, but I mean, I think Borg wins a game against a Rafa.
I don't think
like
he would have won a game. Rafa's hitting down the line winners at close to 100 miles an hour. He's tracking down everything. He's not making errors. He's hitting his backhand 75 miles an hour cross court deep into the corner. He's, you know, hitting spots on his first serve.
Yeah, it's just tough. I'm with you. But this comes back to this whole thing that we were talking about earlier about this dynamic and how players influence each other, obviously. Like, Rafa didn't play in a vacuum, just like Stan didn't play in a vacuum. The bigger question, and this is what you and I do for a living and have done for a living for a long time, is, look, we don't go out and ask players to play amazingly. We don't go out and ask players to play the match of their life or the match of the history of tennis in order to win. What we do is find ways or ask players to go out and do things that change that dynamic and improve their chances. And so when we look at the match like that, instead of saying like, hey, Stan needs to go out and just play tennis at a level we've never seen from a human being before. The bigger
we would never ask anyone.
Right. Can we? Right. So instead of talking about that, the bigger question here is there things that Wawrinka could have done to bring Nadal's level down to something that is defeatable?
Okay, so this is a serious question, even though it might sound like one of the stupidest questions that we've had on this podcast.
Oh, okay, I'm ready. I'm looking forward to this.
Do you remember the match? And I wonder if maybe – I don't know if you've seen this highlight or not, but do you remember a match where I think it was Madison Brengel was playing Serena Williams, and she has a coaching intervention on a changeover where her coach comes over and sits down, and she's winning, shockingly, because – she's not supposed to beat Serena Williams. Mm-hmm. And she turns to her coach and says, I think she's just really surprised about how bad I am. Maybe if I just hit it even worse, she won't know what to do. Or something like that. And I'm dead serious. She actually said this. And she's funny. She's got a lot of personality. I like her. But I started cracking up when I heard it. So this is the first thing I think of. Well, first of all, do you remember this? Did you ever hear this?
No, I hadn't heard. I mean, you know what I'm going to be Googling the moment that we end recording
YouTube
today.
It's so good. It's
oh,
so good.
You know I'm going to do that.
And
okay.
I know I misquoted. I know for sure that I misquoted, so I apologize, but I'm going off of memory here.
Sure.
And so this is the first thing that I think is Stan was clubbing the ball. You can't really hit the ball a lot better than what he was doing, or at least I don't think it's reasonable to ask someone to do that. So therefore, what I would say is you got to go the other way. I mean, after the first set, I probably would have looked at Stan if you were able to coach like in a college match or something and said, look, like you're hitting the ball great. it seems like the better you hit the ball, the better he's hitting the ball. His level is super high. Let's bring this whole match down to a human level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for Stan, that would be throwing up not moon balls like Andre Agassi style where they're flat, but he's pretty far back there. He's making great contact. It would be hit the highest, heaviest, most topspin you possibly can and try and throw the ball up into the middle of the court, onto the baseline. Do whatever you can to try and get Rafa to spin the ball more.
Mm. Okay. You're basically just asking to do what Rafa's, you know, made a career out of.
Yeah, but not move it around. Like, just literally, like,
Up
almost,
the middle. Yeah, to remove the angles, change the pace.
Don't give him anything. Try and get him to start brushing. Like, every now and then, throw a junk side spin slice into his backhand. Like, just try and get him to brush up on the ball, brush up on the ball, brush up on the ball. And then we know that Stan's capable of bringing out the pole axe.
Oh, sure. Just pull the trigger when he needs to, yeah.
Exactly. So if you can get him to brush a little bit, then try and pull the trigger and crack some balls down the line or come forward or do whatever. But almost say, look, like, you're probably going to lose a set here. But if you can bring his level down,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's going to be the only chance you have. Because honestly, it seemed like you just weren't going to hit through him.
Right.
I mean, you can't ask a guy to go out there and hit 100-mile-an-hour angles all day long. That's not feasible.
Right.
So that's the best thing that I've come up with.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's really two options here. And one is to change the pace or type of play. Or two is to change the patterns. The problem with changing the patterns is, you know, when push comes to shove, Nadal's just a better mover than Wawrinka. And there's just no way around that. And so if we change the patterns, that generally is going to involve changing the movement and maybe involving more movement on Wawrinka's part. You know, to him, really, that means he has to hit more balls down the line. But that really plays into what Rafa, the thing that we know Rafa does better than him, which is just move better. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure that changing the patterns would have been the answer. You know, if he takes more backhands down the line, maybe. You know, that might be the thing that could kind of tilt things in his direction. But then the problem is also, I mean, you're still taking Rafa's forehand into your backhand down the line, which isn't, you know, exactly a happy place for anybody to be, let alone somebody who's trying to win a French Open title. I mean, I think there's a lot of value in this idea of kind of slowing the pace, not the racket head speed, obviously, but the pace of the ball, going heavier, going more central and deeper, and taking away the angles, taking the running out of it a bit, and seeing how that plays out. If nothing else, even if you do that for a while, you know, there's this whole idea of, and this may or may not actually have worked in this case, but look, nobody can play perfect tennis forever. Like, that's just not in the cards. Otherwise, you know, we would have seen somebody win, like, every match for 5 years. I mean, you just eventually, like, you have to start missing. Eventually, you have to start playing at a level that's lower. And, you know, we've both used this in college matches before, coaching college, but I'm sure you've probably used it with some of you guys on the tour. Is, look, if you're not playing real well, stay out, or they are playing really well, just find a way to stay out there. You know, make the points last longer, take as long as you can between points. Just do everything you can to keep them out there long enough for their level to drop. And this applies, guys. I mean, if you're listening to this and you are competing recreationally, I can't tell you how much this tip is worth, but it's worth a lot. is because if you're playing recreational tennis, I promise you the person you're playing cannot play well forever, because if they could, they wouldn't be playing recreational tennis. And, you know, so this idea, look, if I can keep them out here long enough, their level's going to drop. And if Stan maybe found a way to change that dynamic and extend the points more, change the way that Rafa was hitting a little bit, and do this over a period of time, and then maybe just pull the trigger here and there to kind of catch Rafa off rhythm or catch him out of position, then, you know, I think that maybe was his best chance of turning things around and paying dividends. Can't really think of a whole lot else that he could have done that doesn't just involve what I always hate, which is just saying, hey, play better or serve better or do these kind of nebulous kind of instructional things that, I mean, how do you tell a player to play better? Like, that's just absurd.
I mean, I thought Stan was pretty, we should state this clearly too. I thought Stan was pretty locked in.
Yeah, I think he hit the ball great.
I don't think he had any kind of mental problem. I don't think he was unprepared to play that final. I don't think he was worried about Rafa getting 10, or there was no shortcoming on his part whatsoever. Right. I think he flat out got beat.
Yeah, this was an almost unstoppable force, meaning a definitely immovable object.
Well,
you know, and in that collision, like, being almost unstoppable just doesn't get it done, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, well, let's move past the French then and talk a little bit about the grass, because obviously we're right in the middle of, well, sadly we're right in the middle of grass court season right now, because grass court season is so short. That's the sadly part. You know, and let's talk a little bit about what's happened so far, the results of note, and then also, obviously, the kind of big grass court tournament coming up, which you may or may not have heard of before, known as Wimbledon.
Well, I'm actually in London right now. Wimbledon qualies starts this upcoming Monday, so we've got some guys over there. Mm-hmm. So far on the grass, Rafa has not played.
Right, he's skipping everything and just going straight into Wimbledon. But I mean, we can start. I guess let's break up. I mean, we've obviously got Halle right now, and then
the London, other one, Queens
London,
Club.
London, Queens. There we go.
We always call it Queens, and
yeah, I just I keep seeing it. It's being listed as London on the ATP website, so it's really throwing me for a loop.
The other London.
Yeah. So you know, if we talk about Harley first, there's been some interesting results there. At least I think so. I don't know. You know, your opinion may differ.
Well, yeah. I mean, I kind of want to just jump in and start talking about Andy Murray, but that's just me.
Well, we can talk about Andy.
I mean, Rogers in the final. We'll stick with Holly, right?
Okay.
Rogers in the final.
Yes. Played pretty clean. Has he dropped a set yet? I don't think he's dropped a set. Has he?
No.
I don't believe so. No. So he's playing cleanly. I mean, you know, Khachanov, dangerous player, got through in two there, and the tiebreak is not, you know, particularly shocking given Khachanov's big game and it being on grass. And he's playing Sasha in the final. I mean, that's a good win for Sasha over Gasquet in three, especially after having lost the first. I mean, you know, Gasquet, I think grass really, really helps Gasquet's game a lot. You know, he's got a nice slice. That funky forehand of his, you know, I don't know. I don't think the grass necessarily helps or hurts that. But I think the way that Gasquet serves with kind of like a very slicey,
The
grass helps him a lot there, and kind of lets him stay in control a little more. I think that's a good win. But you know, there's nothing really that happened so far. At Halle that was shocking to me. You know, I mean, Nishikori got hurt. That's not shocking.
I don't want to spend too long on this, but some people were giving him a lot of heck on Twitter, but you know, whatever. But they were tennis journalists; they weren't like nobody's.
Yeah, I saw that nice little exchange between Rafa and Kyrgios.
Nish got hurt a little, not a lot, and the way that he's managed his career as far back as I can remember, I mean, to the point when he was in juniors, is to be very conservative and to take a very long-term approach. So. Could he have kept on playing? I'm going to say probably. Might he have been able to even win that match against Karen? Possibly. I don't know. Khachanov is good. He's the real deal. He's a young gun. If you're not familiar with him, go and look him up. He's a super nice guy as well. But, you know, Nishikori pulls out, so Khachanov goes through. But besides that, I mean, Nish should be – so. I mean, this is tough. Like, he should be fine for Wimbledon. I mean, he'll certainly be there. He'll certainly play. From all appearances,
and that's what he's playing for. By the way, obviously, when he retires, there, folks. I mean, he's doing that in order to play Wimbledon.
Yeah, but here's the thing about his game too, because he is not Rafa and he is not Fed. His game is very, very much built on movement. Like, imagine if Novak Djokovic all of a sudden just couldn't move as well, he becomes a much, much less formidable player. And Nish really needs that. And if it's a little thing like a calf or a hamstring or an ankle, it doesn't just affect his ability to run down the ball. It actually affects his ability to create and generate force and hit the ball.
Right.
He's not naturally a guy that has a ton of power. He's got tremendous swing speed because everything works very well for him. And so when he loses just a little bit, it really affects his game a lot. And so I feel like when people give him a hard time for managing his career intelligently, it just makes them sound like they don't, like they haven't really done their homework. Right? Like, so anyway, Nish is off to the side for now. He's going to be back at Wimbledon. But I do think, you know, heads up, if he runs into a tough player of the first couple of rounds, it could hurt him a lot. And you got to look for the upset already, because if he's not 100%, we've seen him go out early at Wimbledon before.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I think he's hoping that he'll have those first few days and he can kind of play his way back to full health in the main draw.
Yeah, I mean, he just wants to get healthy. If he's healthy, then he's not worried about the matches. He just needs to be healthy. And the courts at Wimbledon are, you know, the most consistent grass courts that you can find on the
tour. Which helps him, you know, definitely helps him a lot.
Yeah, he doesn't have to adjust to like crazy bounces. He doesn't have to play on a terrible court ever.
Right.
So, you know, he'll be fine. But just upset alert on that one.
Sure.
But besides that, I mean, Sasha came through a really tough draw, frankly.
Yeah.
Beating Cole Schreiber, RBA, and then Gasquet. You know, Fed in the final doesn't get any easier. But I feel really good about his chances against Fed in the final. As much as I love Fed, I feel like Sasha matches up well in Germany, on grass, a little quicker. If he's just pounding the ball and doesn't make any mistakes, that's exactly the kind of game that can bother Fed.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, when people pound the ball and you don't make mistakes, it bothers everybody. But I get what you mean. I think that's where Fed's a little more susceptible than other types of playing. You know, if you just keep the pace on, even if you're not necessarily opening the court with a lot of angles, but you just get him on that little bit rushed, and keep him that little bit rushed, and you reduce his ability. I mean, I think it makes the game more linear. I mean, it takes a lot of his creativity away. I think that really bothers him. So
the only thing that I'm hesitant about is I think that the smarter play for Sasha is really to try and rush the Fed forehand and keep the speed of the game very high in terms of keep the velocity very high and linear. I think if he tries to hit through his backhand too much, Fed will go to the slice. And Sasha's just not very good at the net. I mean, Fed's going to beat him if Sasha comes in a lot.
Right.
If it's not coming off of, you know, a massive first serve where he gets an easy ball or something.
Sure.
But if he's coming in for the round, it's trouble.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Fed's had a little experience here and there of, you know, bringing people into the net on his slice backhand on grass courts. We've seen that once or 2,000 times.
If it's fast enough, then it's harder for him to do, but that's right. I mean, he's going to go to.
Yeah, if you're bringing power into the backhand, yeah, I mean, it gets a little trickier. But I mean, you know, if you give him the opportunity, he's you know as good at that as anybody has ever been. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think he has a reasonable chance too. I think at the end of the day, it's all going to come down to how well Fed serves. If he serves well, I don't think Sasha has a whole lot of hope. You know, but if he serves mediocre, then, you know, I think it's there to be had. Let's talk a little bit about Queens, that tournament, which name I forgot. And I guess that brings us to Annie Murray, which you wanted to talk about originally anyway. So
I wish we had done a podcast about that because both me and the player that I'm working with right now, we both called Jordan Thompson beating Annie Murray.
Really?
And everybody thought that we were crazy. Yeah, I mean, Murray's still, to me, he's still having a hangover from the effort that he put in last year to take over number one. I mean, it was a monster effort. Like, I mean, it's easy to forget, I think, how well he played for the second half of last year.
Sure.
He won almost everything.
At a price.
It comes at a price, especially for him. He's not Roger Federer. He's not Rafa. He has a terribly, terribly inefficient forehand. Lendl is basically in his ear berating him to hit the forehand as hard as he can constantly. Because if he doesn't, then it's a little bit of a duck compared to these other guys.
Sure.
He's still got a terribly inefficient serve, and the second serve is still really weak.
Yeah.
I think it seems to me like mentally he's fine, but if he's missing just a little bit of – and this is going to be hard to talk about, but I don't have a better way to talk about it. If he's missing just a little bit of that supernatural motivation that he's had for the last 2 years, I think his level – is significantly less. I mean, it's still very high, but it's less than when he was playing unbeatable tennis at the end of last year.
Well, I mean, that parallels very closely with Djokovic too. You know, like once that motivational level drops and the ability to prepare and sustain drops even a little, I mean, you know, we see it, just the impact that's had on Novak has been massive. And look, we are not going to start talking about Novak again today because we spent, I think, a lot of time talking about Novak lately. But I think you're absolutely right. I still think that that was a bit of a surprise result. I would have seen him dropping to Sam Querrey in the second round. But I've never actually seen Jordan Thompson, who is the 23-year-old young Australian who beat him, currently ranked 90 in the world.
He's been up higher than that. I mean, he's been a challenger player up until the last year. What you'll notice, maybe you didn't watch him, but he's the same guy who beat Ferrer and Brisbane earlier this year. Mm-hmm. He's one of the fastest guys on the tour. He's a rabbit and he's lightning. He's got great balance. He's got a pretty darn complete game, like a lot of the Aussies do. So the matchup with him against Murray is it's pretty hard for Murray to get the ball past him.
Right.
And Ferrer ran into the same thing. So he does very well against guys that don't come forward or can't put the ball away easier.
Right.
He ended up losing in the next round to Querrey. Querrey's got big time weapons and that's how he beat him. So it's just a matchup thing, but obviously when you look at number one in the world, number 90 in the world, people think you're crazy.
Yeah, I mean, no matter how you look at it, that's not a match that any should be losing, you know, theoretically. But, the rest of the draw's been, there's been some really great matches, first of all. A lot of three sets, some really tight ones. I mean, like Berdych over Shapovalov, like 7-6, 6-7, 7-5. Then Lopez over Berdych, 7-6, 6-7, 7-5, exactly the same scoreline, just the tiebreaker scores. Differing.
Dude, I don't know how much of that you got to play, but Feliciano looked awesome.
Yeah, I played none of it, watched a little. And
thank you.
But, you know, I mean, look, he took out my boy Grigor in the next round. I think obviously Lopez is playing very good ball heading into Wimby. And, that's a tournament where he's done some damage in the past, and I think has the ability to really have an impact. He's always going to be more influenced, or I guess his outcomes are going to be more influenced by how quick or slow they make the grass than most of the other players in the draw. But, I think that he has the ability to do some damage.
Well, he's always been known as somebody who's dangerous. So I think when he drew Wawrinka in the first round, it was like, oh, yeah, you know, that's a tough one. Like, Lopez could win that. Oh, there he is. This is upset. You know, Feliciano won. Okay, but it's different to say, like, he's a dangerous guy. He might win that first-round match or the first grass court match that Stan has played since the clay. It's different to say that versus, oh, Philo's going to the final.
Yeah, and I certainly would not say that Philo's going to the final. The thing about this is when I look through the draw, I mean, there's a lot of close calls there. I mean, he's won multiple matches that could just easily have swung the other way. You know, so I don't feel comfortable saying that. I have to see what the draw looks like when it comes out. But can he make a quarterfinal appearance?
Nobody picked him to go to the final of Queens.
Oh, sure. See, and that's
a lot of people would picked him to have an upset maybe in the first round, but not to go all the way to the final. That's what's been really impressive to get through Shardy and get through Berdych and get through Dimitrov and get through Stan he doesn't usually have that much consistency day after day after day after day.
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows what his patterns are. They know how to play him. But I don't know, something about it, when I was watching that Berdych match, he looked more athletic. He looked like he was moving better. He looked like, I mean, he was making adjustments. I mean, he was tracking down lobs and hitting, you know, hot shot winners, which is just not something that, I mean, usually we see Lopez hit maybe a hot shot with a volley or something, but not that kind of on the run shot. So he really impressed me.
I agree. I mean, I think it's a great run for him. I think depending on the draw, it bodes well that he can make a deep run at Wimbledon. And by deep, I want to qualify this and say probably like round of 16 or quarterfinals, which, you know, for Lopez and where he's at now, that's a relatively deep run in a slam.
You know? 16, he would take.
Yeah, he's round. I mean, he's 32 in the world. So obviously this is probably his best surface. But still, there's been some really, really good tennis. And we saw Kokkinakis has made his comeback and took out Milos in the first round as a wild card, and then dropped to Medvedev pretty badly.
Yeah, that's so weird, right? I mean, he beats Milos on grass and then loses 2-2.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of that where obviously he's working his way back in, and we probably can expect some up and down over him from him over the coming months as he settles kind of back into life on tour.
By the way, he's got a wild card into Wimbledon with Jordan Thompson.
Nice.
Yeah, so you'll get to see them playing dubs, and frankly, they're pretty good at dubs. It would definitely be worth tuning in for if you can find that match.
That's not surprising to me. You know, and Grigor coming in strong, which is good to see. I think this is where we'll see him start to pick up some momentum again heading into the hard court season. I know I picked some big things for him this year. I'm not shocked.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, I'm not shocked at the results that he's had on the clay. To me, the way that he came out at the start of the year and was playing, it wasn't surprising to me particularly. I think that he's going to do really well over the grass court season here, and then really, I think, hit his stride and finish strong with the hard courts. So we'll see if I'm right or wrong about that. But I'm saying it out loud right now, loud and clear. That's what I think will happen. And obviously, you know, the draw can play into that. But he's seeded pretty highly. Ranked, I think, 11 right now. So, you know, he shouldn't hopefully get done too badly at Wimbledon. But yeah, I think it's been a good tournament. Some great, entertaining matches. I'm curious to see what happens between Cilic and Lopez tomorrow, because obviously Cilic playing quite well. Took out Isner in straight, Kozlov in straight, Young in straight, and then dropped a set to Muller, who's really tough.
Shout out to both Cilic and Muller. Mueller for being like kind of old now, early to mid 30s, having the best year of his career. I think he's at a career high, like 28, 25, something now. I mean, he looks like he's going to be a top 25 player in a heartbeat. He's going to be tough on the grass.
Wait, Jules Mueller?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's ranked 26 right now. He's 34 and it is his career high.
Yeah. So, but I mean, for sure, he's going to be top 25 at some point this year. And he's just doing it by playing good, smart tennis. He knows his patterns. He knows where to go.
And also, just for the record, one of the most underrated servers on the men's tour.
Yeah.
I mean if you look at serving statistics, Mueller's actually – he is an incredibly good server. And people just don't really realize that about him. But, yeah, his serve is really a very, very effective weapon. So I think we could also expect him to probably have – again, he's one of these players that to me it's all about draw. You know, if he gets a good draw, I think he could go fairly deep. He certainly is very capable of upsetting somebody in the right circumstances. But we'll see, you know, how that comes out for him. A lot of it's just matchups. So, you know, I guess we'll talk about Wimbledon now and what we think will happen. It's hard, obviously, without the draw, so we'll probably have to come back to it. But I think one of the two big questions to me, really, maybe we'll just talk about this instead of really talking about the whole tournament, is what sort of tennis do we think Novak Djokovic will come out and play? You know, do we think Djokovic is going to come out and do well at Wimbledon?
Well for him?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, he's obviously we've talked ad nauseum about his drop.
I can tell you I don't see him making the final.
No. I'm more wondering, is he going to make it through the first three or four rounds?
I think he makes it first through three rounds. The thing that's really tough is he's in this really strange place right now. I don't know if Andre is going to come back and do more work with him. I mean, he won, I think. Did he win every match while Andre was there? When he lost, was Andre still there?
I believe he won every match that when Andre was there. I think Andre is – I don't know if Andre's going to be with him at Wimbledon, but my understanding is that partnership is going to continue for now. They both seemed happy with what they had gotten done during that time period.
I think it seemed to me that Andre enjoyed it. I think that he certainly enjoys helping people and sharing the wisdom that he's gained through – some really, really hard experiences in his own life.
Yeah.
I think he's going to have a big impact again. I really do. I think if Andre's not there, then I would probably pick Novak to go out in, I'm going to say third or fourth, maybe quarters, but probably third or fourth. Mm-hmm. It's just a really tough thing because the truth is if the guy makes it to the quarters, it's it's kind of hard to see him losing if he's got a little bit momentum. It's just going to depend on who he's playing.
Yeah, see, I come back to, you might remember that when we were talking about the French before it happened, and we were talking about Novak, and what I was saying about how I just struggle to see him having back-to-back big wins. I think we're still in that space. I mean, you know, when we look at the tournament, he got taken to five. I'm talking about the French now briefly. I mean, he got taken to five by Schwartzman. And then, you know, he gets a win over Ramos Vinolas, which is a good win. You know, I think that was an impressive straight sets victory. And then next match team, out in straights. You know, I just still think he's in that space where, to me, depending on the draw, I could easily see him dropping out in the first 3 to 4 rounds. I also think with a good draw, he could easily make quarterfinals. I just can't see him really getting past the quarters, honestly, given where he's at right now. I think we're still probably another 3 to 4 months away from seeing Novak really get it together if he does the right kind of work, which hopefully he will or is currently doing, which, you know, I think involves him putting on some weight again and rebuilding some of that lost muscle mass and just generally getting himself physically back where he belongs to, you know, be able to play good tennis. I don't think we're ever going to see him dominate the way that he did. I think though that's gone, that's past. But can he be a top 3, top 4 guy? Absolutely. Can he be number 1 again? I think absolutely. He just is never again going to be, I think, like the absolutely dominant number 1 that he was for that stretch that we saw. And, you know, hey, I could be wrong.
Those are – thank you for sharing that, because those are valuable comments. That sounds so cheesy, but I don't know how else to say it. I feel like he looks a little bit healthier. Like, I feel like he looks a little bit stronger. So hopefully he's starting to turn that around. It's pretty subtle, and I don't have any evidence to point to. So, you know, take that with a grain of salt. The thing is, when it comes to Wimby, his game fits really well there. He hits the ball pretty flat, pretty low, very fast. The courts really help him. And, you know, his movement helps him. He still is going to move better than almost everybody in the draw there. Mm-hmm. You know, he's still a wall. Like, we saw him lose the team in Paris. I don't see team beating him on the grass. I mean,
I think it's perfectly possible. The thing to me just is that if Novak's not moving the way that he was, he's not that same wall. He doesn't have, and I know people probably aren't going to like me saying this, but he doesn't have the weapons that some of the guys out there have. He's got a great backhand, but that backhand is 100% reliant on his movement. If he loses a half step, it's not a fraction of the shot that everybody seems to think that it is. And I just think on grass, like, there's just so many guys out there that can come out and bring, you know, 3 sets of high-level aggressive tennis, and he's very susceptible right now. So, you know, the thing to me is I just think there's a lot of different types of players that he can lose to at the moment that he couldn't have lost to, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago. And so, yeah, we'll see what happens, you know. Nadal is a different story, obviously. We're not worried about whether or not Nadal can beat people. More just about how well, but, you know, there's a question, how well is he going to make the transition to having skipped the lead in tournaments? I mean, obviously we know he's practicing on grass right now, but it's not quite
the same
thing.
He's going to be fine. Wait, actually, so let's spell that out for people. He's hitting on grass every single day. He's been hitting on grass for a while. It's not like he hasn't played on grass. Okay.
Yeah.
I think some people have this misconception, like, oh, he played on clay 4 weeks ago and then he hasn't played a grass court tournament. It's his first match on grass. No, the guy's played like 20 practice sets on grass.
Yeah.
Against pros, not against like juniors, but against pros, like top 30 guys. Like, he's ready on the grass. He's just not competing.
Right. Which, so, I mean, and that is important. I mean, I think there's something to be said for competing. And I think it has less of an impact on somebody like Nadal, who's, you know, obviously in this mid-late stage of his career, than it would have on, let's say, Sasha. If Sasha skips the lead in on the grass tournaments, like, I'm very worried about him because he's young. You know, he doesn't have as much match experience. And, you know, it's grass. It's a little funky, you know, depending on how the courts are cut and, you know, the grain of the grass and all these things. Like, it really can be quite funky. It's very temperamental to the weather. And he just doesn't have that breadth of experience. Whereas somebody like Nadal, look, I mean, the guy can, he, at this point in his career, he's played enough matches on grass and, you know, he's won Wimbledon before. So he's no stranger to the surface. He's no stranger to center court. And I think he's going to be just fine. And now he's number two in the world. So, you know, obviously I think he's not going to be worrying about playing on any smaller courts because of ranking. So
he knows how to win Wimbledon. And here's the thing to me. He was – I mean, I don't know that you could be any more confident than what he was coming out of winning number 10 in Paris. I mean, that's one of the greatest achievements in sports. And he's been, to some degree – He certainly hasn't been written off, but I mean, people were starting to talk about like, oh, is Djokovic this unbeatable force? Is he better than Rafa was? Is he better than Federer was? You know, he was doing obviously a lot of the same things that Rafa and Federer did for a couple of years, and he's got some great numbers. I mean, Djokovic has still won the most big titles. You can check out if you Google, like search big titles on Craig O'Shansey's website or the ATP World Tour website, you'll see what we're talking about. But Rafa now has a chance to finish the year number one. He has a chance to close the gap and get within striking distance of the all-time Grand Slam record, which I think people had completely written off after Australia. Like, he's got a lot to fight for here. It looks there's a very good chance that he's going to be super hungry and highly aggressive.
Yeah, I mean, the way he played at the French is he's playing at a different level. I mean, he's playing the kind of tennis that I would have loved to have seen him playing, you know, 5-10 years ago, where he is being more aggressive. And I think he's a better player that way.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, so let's talk really quickly about year-end number one, because, you know, this actually, weirdly enough, is the first time that I can remember where the race to number one, the race to London, actually really means something, because we're seeing so much change around the top with the way that people are playing. And if we look at the race right now, I mean, it's quite fascinating because, usually in years past, it's been, especially this time of the year, it's been fairly stable. And right now, you know, Roger was blowing everybody away at one point where he had more points than Nadal, Djokovic, and Murray combined. But, you know, obviously with Rafa, I mean, Roger having a reduced clay court schedule, as in zero, and Rafa doing what he did now, Rafa's like a very clear leader at number one, and then Roger's coming in at two. Dominic Thiem is number three in the race by a hair over Wawrinka, and then we've got Sasha as a solid gap below that. Then we have Novak. Then we have Andy. You know, it's really looking quite interesting. So who do we think is going to finish the year number one?
Well, I've got Rafa penciled in. If you can dig up the archives, and I said, look, you got to be careful if Rafa goes and plays really well at the French. If he's very aggressive, then he's got a very good shot of winning Wimbledon. If he does that, he's definitely number one. But honestly, even if he just makes the final, I mean, he's there, he's got a huge lead. He's almost 3,000 points ahead of Federer. Like, it seems most likely the safe bet has to be that Rafa is going to be there. You pretty much have to pick Federer to win Wimbledon and win a lot on the hard courts and final the U.S. Open, and for Rafa to lose before the semis in both of those,
right?
And well, not win on the hard courts.
And then, there's something that we have to consider, and I don't want to, and knock on wood, I don't want to curse this because I think it would be bad for tennis, but. You know, we can't guarantee that Rafa will finish the year out.
True. Yeah.
You know, you just never know with the guy. And I don't mean that in any sort of a disparaging way, because obviously he's an absolute warrior, but he has the injury history that he has. Does, you know, can we guarantee that he's going to finish out and play out the entire year? No, we can't. So that you know, that opens up another door. The other big part of the puzzle.
Almost can't. I think he wants that. I think he would be coming back from being number one and losing it and coming back, which he's done this before when Federer was playing lights out, doing it again. I mean, I think the way that he's playing for the legacy right now, like he's playing for the record books.
Sure.
And not just in numbers, but he's really legitimately playing for a legacy. Like if he pushes, he can't be beat. I think that's how it is in his mind. And I think with Moya in his camp, he's still a relatively new voice in the sense that he's more influential than he was in the past. Mm-hmm. I think Moya would say, look, I mean, you can take time off, but go ahead and dominate, finish the rest of this year.
Yeah.
And then skip Australia. Don't skip the hard courts and skip the US Open. He loves it there.
Yeah, see, but that's the thing to me is, I think he would be better off being selective about his hard court season. He could still finish number one, depending on how, you know, the results come out. But I, you know, it depends on how much he, you know, wants to be playing at 35. And being, you know, competitive at 35, that's a big question. But, you know, the other part of the puzzle here is Fed. I mean, I think it's very easy to forget that the last, you know, Fed took his big break and came out and just dominated everybody at the start of the year. He's taken another break, and now here he is in another final. You know, we don't know for sure what Wimbledon is going to play out like, but you can't imagine that he's not going to have... He's openly stated that no more rest for him between now and the end of the year, which means he's got to be feeling good. I think part of the motivation for that is the fact that he would like to finish year-end number one again. And it's certainly not out of the question right now. I mean, yeah, it's a 3,000 gap point, but there's, you know, three tournaments gap between the two of them that they've played. And those are some big tournaments. They're Master Series and a Grand Slam. I mean, there's no reason Fed can't bridge that gap with some great tennis. So, I mean, I think at this point it's likely Nadal will be year-end number one. Fed can catch him. A lot of it's going to come down to what happens over the next month, basically, I think. If Fed doesn't win Wimbledon, then, I mean, and Nadal does, or it goes well, goes deep there, then you can pretty much ride him in pen. Right now I've got him penciled in. I think he's going to do it, but there's no guarantees.
Well, we can say this for sure. Andy Murray's not going to finish number one.
Yeah, he's I think we can say safely that Djokovic isn't going to either.
I think so, but, I mean, if Djokovic comes back and wins Wimbledon, then who knows?
Because... even then, I mean, they still got a lot of work to do, you know. Yeah. We'll see.
Thing that's really interesting to me is Milos Raonic this time last year, I think, was number three.
Yeah, he's not doing quite so crush. He's number 16 in the race at the moment and dropping.
Yeah, he's fallen off hard.
Yep. So that might be something worth talking about next time. But if you have any questions, comments, or things you would like to hear us talk about, then please do shoot us an email. You can reach me at glenn@tacticaltennis.com. One N.
Jacob@tacticaltennis.com.
And just to clarify, when I say one N, there's one N in the Glen. You know, the tennis in Tactical Tennis still has two. And then also, if you haven't already, go ahead and subscribe on the website. We'll be sending out some emails and actually doing some giveaways and whatnot. So that would be worth doing. But if you do, definitely check your spam box, because, you know, sometimes the confirmation email goes there. Outside of that, folks, that's it for this week. Signing off. Have a good one.
Cheers.